With Governor Victor Atiyah at his office in downtown Portland, Oregon. The interview for the Oregon Historical Society's Clark Hansen. The date is June 7th, 1993, and this is tape 33, side one. So we were talking about the Northwest Power Planning Council.
Yeah. I recall telling you that I thought this was important. I looked at power as being, that is, in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and western Montana, as a lake, and that you can't regulate a part of the lake. You can't regulate and lower the water level at Oregon and raise it in Washington, or, you know, that kind of thing. It was all one pool, if you will. Mm-hmm. And that was a general concept. And that's when I know I told you, I got Lee Johnson to do a little Kissinger shuttling and told him, don't shove anybody into a corner. And let's just kind of slowly work this around. And he made many trips to see Governor Swindon and Governor Evans and then Governor Ray and finally Spellman, and let's see. No, I guess Dixie was still there. And, you know, just gradually get it closer so that we could begin to agree on something as four governors, which of course we needed to, and inform our congressional delegation. Now we four governors have agreed on all of this. Mm-hmm. And it deals with the Northwest, so when you go to Congress, you've got the governors agreeing and you got most or all of your congressmen and senators agreeing. And so, what are, you know, back in Washington, D.C., well, if you guys all agree, I guess that's okay with us. And away you go. So that's the general theory of what we did. And that's how it actually all came about.
What about the problem, and I'm not sure whether we discussed this before or not, about the public versus private power rates, the rates coming from the...
We weren't dealing with that.
We weren't dealing with that.
PUDs versus investor owns,
right,
and all the rest. Uh-huh. That was a separate battle that each state had to deal with on its own. Uh-huh. The point was the basic fundamental source of power, at least so far as Oregon and Washington was concerned, was the Bonneville system. And that system itself was one that favored PUDs because that was part of the legislation that created the PUDs, and that they would get, let me say, first choice on that power. But that was entirely different. We were trading about power in its broadest sense, and how much power is available, and that we all share it equally, and that we all understand each other's problem, and if we're going to conserve, we'll all conserve it. And, you know, it gets into it now with fishery. Fishery is something we introduced, and that's a big deal now. But that was something we put in. But you can understand it right away. Idaho's got a problem with Oregon's use of the fishery and Washington's, but that's been long-standing. And, you know, they want to get some of their fish back, just like they would want some of the energy that comes out of Bonneville Power. But those, I mean, we're getting more complex than we need to. The whole point is that there was this interdependence, and it was essential that we all work together.
Who did you first appoint for being
representative? I appointed Herb Schwab and my goodness, I can even see his face.
It wasn't Bob Duncan, was it?
No. Uh-uh. Bob Duncan came later. Roy Hemingway.
All
right. Roy Hemingway. Roy was very instrumental, incidentally, and was helpful at the time we were running this whole power bill and back in Congress. Herb Schwab was a highly respected chief judge of the appeals court and very knowledgeable. That was a tandem of two good people, very good people. Mm-hmm. When you start something new, you really have to start off on the right path. Herb was there at the beginning of the appeals court. He got it started on the right path. Mm-hmm. So I wanted him there on the council. Hemingway knew all of the ins and outs and all the details of the bill itself. So that was a pretty good team of people to get the thing started with.
The Oregonian had some comments about the activating the domestic and rural power authority.
Yeah.
It was devised by the Straub administration, and was a mechanism for getting cheap power in the state. What was your relationship with that setup?
I didn't think it was a very good idea, but I thought, well, what the heck?
Uh-huh.
I don't think it's really going to work, but what the heck. It was not something that I didn't have the same degree of energy behind that as I did the power bill itself.
Mm-hmm. Going on then, there was a special session that year, and at one point you said there are those in society whose voices have been loudest in recent years, who have scorned the need to provide jobs and who are angered at profits. These same individuals are hailed as champions of government services. The fact that you are here today to cut budgets is proof enough how wrong they are. Do you recall that? What was the session like, that special session then?
That was in 81?
That was in 1981. Actually, we could talk about that in a little bit, because that actually comes after the first session, so we can. There was a special session on October 24th.
That was to reduce was that a budget reduction?
That was a budget.
Okay.
Yes.
What I was saying was that government only runs if there are people working to pay taxes. I was trying to get the message across.
Right.
If people aren't working, the only source of revenue so we can spend money mm-hmm. at the government level was the taxes from people that are working.
Right.
I was trying to make that connection in people's minds. Some people think it just comes out of nowhere, mm-hmm. not realizing that it's working people and successful companies that make profits or make wages that pay taxes so the government can spend money. Doesn't happen any other way.
One newspaper referred to your this sentiment of yours as being as best illustrating your own worldview, that if there is a shortage of jobs, there's a shortage of income, and if there's a shortage of income, there's a shortage of taxes to pay for the government programs, which is just what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
His proposed 1981-83 budget bears out his theory. When the economy is unhealthy, it is those people dependent on government services who invariably suffer the consequences. You feel that's pretty accurate?
This is very accurate.
That was Willamette Week.
They finally said something right.
Of course, they're quoting you. So. But do you feel that sums up your philosophy?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Now, that's the problem at the federal level. See, they can't operate. They can operate with a deficit. The states can't. Most states can't. Certainly, Oregon can't. And so there is a real truism. Back there in Washington, they can print more money. We don't print money. Mm-hmm. The only way we exist is from the payment of taxpayers. If the entire state stopped working, there is no money. You can't do anything, whether you want to or not. Welfare, or put people in prisons, or whatever you want to do, you can't do it. The only source of money is people working, paying taxes. There isn't any earth.
You also, in terms of programs that you were looking at, legislative proposals for this coming session in 1981, you were looking at the possibility of adjusting laws regulating Oregon's scenic rivers.
Oregon what?
Laws relating to Oregon's scenic rivers, and also the future of the state LCDC. Mm-hmm. What did you have in mind in those areas?
Well, nothing had much been done about really a good review of whether or not. You see, it wasn't a matter of what streams we're going to put into it, that is scenic rivers, but whether or not the rivers should be put into the Scenic River Act. And nothing had been done. You know, no real review had been taking place for quite a long period of time. It just seemed appropriate to do it. This wasn't any great push by anybody. It just seemed like a good idea to get that in a less combative spirit. You know, a time when it's cool and in the shade, that you just take a look at it. The LCDC, that was kind of an ongoing thing with me. I've been greatly disappointed by some of my appointments. I pushed real hard to get acknowledgement of all cities and counties, which took me into my second term to get that job done. Constantly alert, all of it related to the fact that I was aware that effectively there was a moratorium during the course of coming to an acknowledged plan. And that once there was an acknowledged plan, all of the emotions just cooled off. Now there's a plan, it's done, it's finished. I mean, there's no point in arguing anymore, it's done. And so the things, all of that controversy would cool down once there was a plan acknowledged. Prior to that time, it was constant agitation and effective moratorium. So I was pushing to get that, I wanted to get over that hump, I wanted to get over that hurdle. Again, this is part of my economic development and diversification. That was part of the thing I was working toward.
Was LB Day running the LCDC while you were a governor?
No, DEQ.
DEQ?
Yeah, he was DEQ.
Oh, I thought he was on LCDC, but he... Who was... Was that Hansel that was...
Yeah, it could have been Hansel. I'm trying to recall back, but I know specifically working with LB on some DEQ matters, so that's why I say DEQ. But I made some appointments that just didn't work out. I met with the commission, had dinner with them. I would, try to cajole them or get them to get a perspective of what really was happening and how they had to really move it along. I kept working with Wes Gavarsen and Ross and, you know, kept pushing, you know, give me a list of where the acknowledgments are and who's not yet acknowledged, and it went on and on constantly. But the whole thing was a matter of putting the whole thing to bed. We had to get that job done. You know, this is, again, a matter of economic development to me. Yeah, that was really part of it. I would say this, that I used the fact that we did have statewide land use planning as a reason why companies ought to come to Oregon. See, there was a lot of a lot of people hated it, and I can understand that, and didn't like it, thought it was an impediment, and yet I used it as a plus, I'd say. And besides, you can come to Oregon. You know what's, if you pick a piece of property that you can build a plan on, you know what was going to happen around you. I mean, this is a plus for you. You can go to California, you don't know what's going to be happen to your next door neighbor. You don't know what's going to happen in back of you. In Oregon, you know. So I was using it as one of my tools in attracting people to Oregon.
And you were successful in that.
Yeah, people like that.
You also said that you were going to seek legislation to make racial harassment a crime because there was a growing problem of bigotry in Oregon. What kinds of programs were you thinking of or policies?
The whole thing, this was really a surprise to the legislature and anybody. I used that in my address to the legislature. And it came as, just sort of out of nowhere for them, that is. But what really triggered it was there was cross-burning in a black man's home in Milwaukee, I think it was. And I was personally incensed by that. And I remember we were talking earlier about bullies and how they become more aggressive if you leave them alone. And so I talked to Dave Frohmeyer. And we talked to the people, Justice Department out of Region 10 in Seattle. I said, I want to come up with something that's going to really hit these folks hard. What we ultimately came up with is making racial and religious harassment a felony. There was a misdemeanor. Now we're making it a felony. That's how we finally came down. And it was just a matter that, and not even the law, which we did get passed. But just that the government was saying that this is unacceptable, the governor was saying, this is unacceptable, just saying it, you know. But we had a law to go along with it. But just to say it was unacceptable, this is not something we're going to tolerate. So that was part of what I wanted to get done. It will now collapse time, because that bill, which I thought would pass, you know, Democrats control the legislature, mm-hmm. they're for the little guy, we're for the blacks and minorities. I thought this is going to go sailing right through. It passed at 1:30 in the morning on the last day of the session. And I had to badger Ted Kulongoski and Ruth McFarlane and to get that bill passed.
Why? What was their opposition to it?
I don't know.
They didn't explain, or?
Well, they were just trying to jack in some other things, and I don't know. But can you imagine Ted Kulongoski and Ruth McFarlane?
Were they concerned that maybe you might get credit in an area that would pull in votes for you that might otherwise go to them?
I can't answer that. You have to. They didn't, you know, we talk about some things, but, you know, one thing is talking and what's actually behind their mind.
At this point, Kulongoski was probably thinking about running for governor, wasn't he?
Maybe, maybe not, I don't know. And what I'm just now telling you is not public. I didn't use it in the course of my my run against him. And yet I find it incredible. Well, first of all, incredible it didn't pass earlier. Incredible that we had to wait to 1:30 in the morning, the last day of the session. It was probably one of the last handful of bills that passed. And what accidentally, after it passed, I went home and went to bed, and they finished off the session. But I can remember sitting in my office with the two of them. Well, but back to the subject itself. I wanted the statement. Remember earlier we talked about the possession of 1 ounce of marijuana, and I said, right, the state is now saying it's okay to use marijuana. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's what a kind of a statement I was looking at. It is not okay in Oregon mm-hmm. to racially and religious harass anybody. Mm-hmm. And it was very curious afterward. There was somebody, white supremacist or whatever, up in Washington distributing material. He's from Oregon. Well, what we're doing just now is exporting our bigots and bullies. It was now a felony in Oregon to do that. Hmm. I don't understand even why today that isn't used, because this whole thing has been, you know, kind of stepped up, and why that statute isn't being used, or why somebody is not, again, making a strong statement in that respect like I did. But anyway, it just came just out of nowhere as far as the legislature is concerned for me to say I want this bill to be passed, making racial and religious harassment a felony.
Speaking of crimes, you were also trying to get bonds passed for building straight
crime. Yeah, that's the other thing I never understood. And I really vented my frustration, because actually during my term we had three attempts at this.
Right.
Twice by my initiation, once by Jim Hill. And when they failed, I said, I just don't understand it. People are saying to me, put those rascals in jail. But why they say, but don't build jails to put them in, it was a contradiction that I never understood. Mm-hmm. I never understood it. And yeah, you're right. We needed some jails. But it's interesting, the electorate is, how contrary they can be.
In February of 1981, you went to an annual National Governors Association meeting in Washington, D.C., and you met with President Reagan and his cabinet. What were your impressions?
That was real interesting. It was really interesting going now into a friendly atmosphere, or relatively so, on mm-hmm. appointments that you could get. One of the things I found very interesting was my visit with Interior Secretary Jim Watt, who was quoted as saying many things. What we were concerned about, remember I told you about Western states and state mm-hmm. special interests, and the Interior has a lot to do with it. Mm-hmm. And trying to get at least Oregon's viewpoint and some communication going with the Secretary of Interior. The one thing he did say, and I don't quote Jim Watt very often, but he's right, was that he said you cannot move fast enough to the left for some of these, and I'll use the word now, super environmentalists, because if you finally get to the position that they want, they have now moved to another position further to the left. He said you can't move fast enough to the left. I remember him saying that. Incidentally, it was one thing that he did say too, which I don't necessarily agree with, but he was quite an imbued Republican. He says what's good for the Republicans is good for the nation. Well, you know, I don't really agree with that, but that's the kind of guy he was. But it was good. It was a very... I went from Jimmy Carter's term as a president and into the now Reagan and the new federalism and let's return the power back to states and so we jump on it. You know,
he would have been just elected. He would have just come into office the previous month.
Yeah, but you recall part of the thing he was talking about was this new federalism.
Right.
And so we were going to take advantage of that as much as we could. Briefly, if I may sidetrack, Mount St. Helens blew up, Jimmy Carter came out. I would tell you, you know, people have asked me about presidents because, of course, I knew Nixon, but not during the time I was governor. But during this period of time, Carter, Reagan, Bush, and, prior to that, I ran in 74, got to know Gerald Ford. Right. So now we have Ford, Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, and Bush. In a general category, the coolest of them was Jimmy Carter. Next in order was, I think, Nixon. I'm going to now shift words. Reserved was Reagan. The two warmest of the group was Ford and Bush. Very warm. That's a diversion.
Huh.
But now we go back, we've got a Republican administration. I'm a Republican, the doors are really kind of open and new federalism, so we're gonna take advantage of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You also met with David Stockman too, of the Department of...
Management. He was budget management, yeah. Mm-hmm. Management and budget. I guess they don't want BM, they want MB.
That's understandable.
There was a cocky, egotistical man. Mm-hmm. Really. Met with him later when he left government and was working for one of the... big financial companies in New York.
In New York, yeah.
And opinionated.
He was described by a lot of people as brilliant, though. Would you have described David Stockman that way, or?
Yeah, he's a very, very bright man. Again, though, remember we talked about it earlier. These very bright guys just can't tolerate anybody that's not as bright as they are. And I suppose that's part of the why I say the words I say about Stockman. He was right in many respects. He couldn't really get much done. He really wasn't very amenable to really conversing with anybody to convince them in a form. This is the way it is, and there's no other way. Mm-hmm. You know, period. Now get the hell out of here. And... yeah, we did. Met with him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How did the Governors Association go in general? That meeting, was it a productive?
Yeah, meeting? But the governors' meetings, by and large, were mostly nonpartisan. And if there looked like there was going to be partisanship, we would kind of rail against it. Every once in a while, the Democrats, there was a majority of them more than Republicans, and they kind of want to take the bit in their teeth, but I would say in the average, this probably was, knowing the potential pitfalls of all these big shots, governors, with their own egos, mm-hmm. and the partisan, you know, this would be a good hotbed for that, that is partisanship, but it rarely surfaced.
What's the relationship, the rapport and the atmosphere like in those meetings? Do governors, when they get together in a big room, is there a sense of camaraderie or a competition or does it vary just from person to person?
In a good sense, it was a camaraderie. Uh-huh. We're all governors. We've all gone through campaigns. One's Republicans, another Democrat. Mm-hmm. But we weren't contesting. You know, if we'd been two governors from the same state, it'd right. been dynamite. But you see, I'm a governor from Oregon, and I can't really. I'm not a threat to the governor of Illinois.
But do you say to the governor of Illinois, say Jim Thompson, do you say, Jim, you know, I have as governor, I have such and such problem, or I'm dealing with such and such in Oregon. How do you deal with it in Illinois?
That was the thing that I missed the most. Uh-huh. And matter of fact, with the Republican governors, where we had some control over agenda, and even Western governors, I tried very hard to have what I called private meetings. I don't mean one-on-one private meetings, where the governors would sit down and talk to each other. Now, here we get back into this Palace Guard business. Staffs didn't really like that. They didn't want their governors sitting in with talking with other governors, you know.
And why?
They were afraid their governor might say something or come back with some ideas they didn't like or whatever. So it was very hard to get, where all of us governors would sit down and talk to each other. And so it would happen, but more on a casual basis, standing in the hall or maybe sitting down for a cup of coffee or, you know, and that's not the atmosphere. You don't get the most out of it. That was the thing I yearned for the most, the thing I would seek the most, what I find most productive. Going to governor's meetings just to have plenary sessions just was no interest to me at all. But what I might possibly learn from my fellow governors was some reason that I'd wanted to go. So there wasn't as much of that as there should have been.
In the next month of 81, there was the Dorchester Conference, and of course Bob Packwood started that back in the 1960s, mm-hmm. and you gave a keynote speech for that. You said at that point that Oregonians have let the elite take over in government, and that they believe that government's role is to take care of its citizens. I guess this goes back to what we were saying before. You know, your analogy of what a Republican or a Democrat would, how they would look at it.
Yeah, it gets down to really a level of comfort you have with the people and respect you have for them. Without being unduly harsh, but I will be, the Democrats say, we're smarter, you give us the money, and we'll spend it, mm-hmm. and we'll take care of you. And that, to me, it gets back to, maybe early in our discussions I may have said it, gets back to the pre-1776, where the king was going to take care of us. Mm-hmm. You know, don't worry, the king will take care of us. Mm-hmm. And Jefferson said, and I'm sure I've said this to you, as we were forming our government, I wonder if the people can run our governments, and that's how we came down. So I'm on the people's side running the government. I still believe that. They'll make mistakes, as I've said before, but I still believe it.
How did you feel about the Dorchester Conference in general?
Oh, I think the Dorchester Conference is one of the finest formats I've ever seen in my whole life. Huh. And I would tell my media friends, they're down there, you know, they're waiting for something to happen. And I said, you're down here for a different reason than I am. Mm-hmm. I'm down here because I think this is a great opportunity for people to participate. But especially is once they've decided an issue, there's no blood on the floor. They voted, and then they go on to another issue. And so it's an exercise. Young people, old people, politicians, non-politicians, farmers, a whole mix of things. And everybody gets to participate, sit around the table, debate with one another, get up on the floor, debate. And, it's a marvelous format, marvelous, unlike anything else. And so I've always thought the Dorchester Conference, I don't care about the issues, you know.